Exodus chapter 18, verse 13. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, and he said, "What is this thing that you're doing? Why do you sit by yourself all alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto evening?" And Moses said unto his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another. And I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws." And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, "The thing that thou doest is not good." Now, wait a second. Isn't making known God's statutes and laws a good thing? Well, yeah, that's a good thing. But what you're doing, how you're doing is not good. "Thou wilt surely wear away," verse 18, "both thou and this people." You've heard me say before, imagine the DMV line. You know, this is, you imagine this line from morning till day, a line of people standing there to have their disagreements adjudicated by Moses. "Thou shalt wear away both thou and this people that is with thee, for this thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, toward God, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way therein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people capable or able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be the rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens, and let them judge the people all the time, all seasons. And it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge, so shall it be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee. If thou shalt do this thing, and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure, and all his people shall also go to their place in peace." You know, we live in a day, as I mentioned a moment ago, where man is aggressively trying to redefine the definition of a family. We see that sex outside of marriage is now expected and celebrated. We see that divorce has now become accepted as part of the norm. And now we have seen in these last 3 years that man is even aggressively pushing to legalize same-sex marriage. You know, ladies and gentlemen, God's long-suffering has tolerated a lot of nonsense, but God has not approved of any of it. And understand how Jesus responds to a question about marriage. In Matthew chapter 19, he expounded upon God's ideal, God's intent for marriage, and he said this, "Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female?" And he says, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." So how do we know what God's will is? Well, Jesus said, go back to the beginning. Look at what God created. We talk about this frequently. God had a clean slate. God created all animal life, created at once in pairs. He spoke, created male and female, created he them, and it was all good. God formed man differently, created in God's likeness, in God's image, breathed the breath of life into his nostrils, and he became a living soul, and he had just created Adam. Stopped and made this observation. Everything I've done is good, but it's not good that a man should be alone. I will make and help meet for him. I will make a complement. I will make a completer. I will give man exactly what he needs. Now again, ladies and gentlemen, you can pause right there and say, what's God going to do next? In fact, I imagine the angels did that. What's God going to do? God could have done anything. God could have, as I joke frequently, God could have given him a set of golf clubs. God could have given him a man's best friend, a nice collie or something to keep him company throughout life. That's not what God did. In fact, God could have created another dust pile, blown the breath of life into her nostrils, and then brought them together. But that's not what God did. God took a part from Adam. A part of Adam was missing. Adam wasn't whole. He wasn't complete. And God, from this rib, made the woman compatibly in every way, complementary in every way, including physically, anatomically. And God brought them together in the union of marriage, and as Jesus referenced it, Adam even said, "What God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." So we know what God's original design was. We know what His intent was. Now, folks, we also know that God established the realm of civil government. We saw last week why God established it. It was not to oppress, according to the Scripture, but to protect good and to punish evil so that man may live peaceably in all godliness. But there is one form, or should I say, is there one form that's more in line with God's design or intent for government? Well, how would we find that? Again, I would propose that we go back to the beginning and see how God designed it when He first designed it. So what was the original form of government that He established? Well, when we think of Israel, it's likely that our original conception is wrong. We think of kings like David or Solomon. We think of a monarchy. And while it's true that God was to be their king, Israel in its original form was not a monarchy. The nation of Israel was a commonwealth of 12 sovereign tribes, or might I say states, with legal fixed boundaries, a common worldview, and a unifying constitution, or we call it the Torah. Now, we often think of the law of God, the Torah, as being only a spiritual document. However, that's not correct. The law consisted of three sections. There, first of all, was the law, which was God's morality. This transcends time. Things like do not murder, do not steal, do not commit adultery, just as true and relevant for us today as it was at Mount Sinai when God gave it. But there were also within the Torah the statutes, which was God's ceremonial system of sacrifice given for the tabernacle and then future the temple. These were types or shadows or pictures, as we see in the Bible, that in and of themselves could not forgive a single sin. But they were pictures pointing to the sacrifice, which could forgive all sin. And done in faith, looking forward to the Lamb of God, which took away the sin of the world, these were efficacious, done in faith, limited to that, but they in and of themselves could not take away any sin. By the way, this sacrificial system of Moses ended with the sufficiency of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and we know without doubt because the veil of the temple between the holy place and the Holy of Holies was rent in twain from top to bottom. No longer do we need a high priest after the order of Aaron to intercede for us. We have the living high priest after the order of Melchizedek in heaven. And we can, because of him, approach the throne room of mercy and grace with boldness and confidence at any time. Now, the third area of the law, the Torah, was the judgments, God's civil law pertaining to the well-being and safety of the people. Now, folks, within this comprehensive nature of this law, listen, there were policies that dealt with basic banking and business, fair weights and measures, fair trade, debt, bankruptcy. A person was limited as to the amount of debt he could assume. You had the ability to mortgage up to 6 years the value of your labor. You could mortgage your land, but you couldn't sell it. You could mortgage it or lease it for up to 50 years. Then it would be returned to your heirs and to your family. The people were taught to be productive, to be prepared to lend, but don't be enslaved to debt. If you were caught cheating in business, you paid it back with a penalty. If you stole something, you didn't go to jail. You paid it back fourfold and worked off the value of that. Folks, if we put that into practice today, that would solve much of what ails us. There were rules for sanitary safety, whether it be the placement of the latrines or the proper washing of your hands and dishes or the putting of sick people into quarantine. Why? Because God is concerned with the health and well-being of His people. They had rules so that they couldn't be overworked. All were required to take certain days of rest, both employee and employer, and even the animals alike. There were rules that pertained to taking care of the poor. There weren't handouts, but charity, where the poor could work for their food and feel the satisfaction of providing for their own families. There were rules that pertained to morality and the family. There were rules that pertained to military service. There were rules that pertained to judgment. No man was found guilty without a fair trial, and guilt could only be established at the mouths of at least two or three witnesses. And as we saw last week, God didn't create an all-powerful central government. In fact, man's first attempt at that was at Babel, and God dispersed it with the division of the languages. God designed and assigned different areas of responsibility to the different areas of government. First of all, it's up to the individual, self-government, to take care of your own body and your own person, your own health and welfare. Then there's family government. The family, the parents are supposed to take care of their children. We're supposed to nurture them and care for them and raise them and provide for them and educate them and teach them right from wrong and teach them how to work. And then one day when we're in our latter years and our children are in the prime of life, they're supposed to take care of the parents. Civil government is only to ensure the safety and well-being of the overall people, the citizens of Israel, defending their life, their liberty, and their property. And in the first dispensation, there was certain work that was set aside for the priesthood. Well, that no longer is enforced today, but we do have a fourth area of government, the ecclesia, the church government, and we're the ones that are responsible for charitable issues and then proclaiming the moral truth and holding each other accountable morally. But understand, as you look at this, Israel's not ruled by a king or a giant central government. During times of major crisis, God would raise up a ruler, a judge, whom the people consented to. First, there was Moses that led them out of tyranny. Then there was Joshua, the military general that led them in the conquest of the promised land and divided up the land. Then, throughout the book of Judges, periodically, God raised up a leader to lead them out of oppression, somewhat like the 13 colonies calling upon a certain judge in 1775 to help lead them out of tyrannical oppression. They were a commonwealth of 12 tribes or states governed by one rule of law. There was no need for major taxes as there was no standing central government and no standing army. There was a militia of every able-bodied man across the 12 tribes. And listen, they trusted in God by following His instruction, by trusting God's designs rather than putting their confidence in powerful central government or in a powerful individual man. God instructed them to choose out from among you capable men. Boy, if we use this criteria today, wouldn't we be better off? That were God-fearing, that loved truth, and hated covetousness. I'd have to tell you, I think we would clear 95% of Congress with that criteria. And we would clear at least that much out of our state legislature. And these were to judge righteously in all matters according to the law. There was an assembly of elders that represented the tribes themselves in a national assembly, according to Numbers chapter 10, verses 2 through 4. Then there were elders even in the gates of each individual city that were to judge in city matters, according to Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 18. By the way, emphasized over and over and over again, and one of the reasons that God brought judgment upon Israel was because they weren't to have favoritism to the poor or favoritism to the rich. Justice was supposed to be blind. Bribery was forbidden. The goal was righteousness for all people. By the way, as you read references from the Old Testament regarding the future millennial reign of Christ, what do you see? You see righteous judgment for all the people on the planet for that 1,000 years. But unfortunately, in 1 Samuel, as Samuel, the last judge, was nearing death, the people were fearful because the Philistines were an imminent threat to their security. And rather than trusting God, how do you trust God? By obeying His instruction and following His law. Instead, the scripture says repeatedly, There was no security. There was no safety. There was no order. Why? Because every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. Now, folks, think about what our founders said. Benjamin Franklin made this statement: only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters. Folks, man has to be governed. Man is either governed internally by the power of God, or if not, he must be governed externally by the strong power of the state. Now, if you do away, now think about the path that we're going on in the United States of America. If we do away with self-government, which we have, it's no longer right and wrong, it's your victims. I'm no longer a drunk, I'm a alcoholic. Folks, if you're a sinner, you can repent and turn from it. If you're just sick, then you're just a victim. There's nothing you can do about that. But we have done away with this idea of right and wrong and repentance, so we've done away with the ability to be self-governing. We've completely destroyed the family. We overly sexualized women in the 60s and took them off the pedestal that God had placed them on. And now in a super sexualized society, it's all about sex, sex, sex. We've seen sex outside of marriage. We've seen rampant divorce. We've seen the family destroyed. And now with this idea of redefining the family into whatever we want it to be, folks, if the family doesn't stand for something, then it means everything, and it basically is meaningless, which was the goal of Karl Marx. Marx thought that religion and the family were two tools of capitalism. And if we didn't have families, then there would be no need to own stuff and pass it down to your heirs. Therefore, let's just do away with all families. Men and women were just to be like animals. And if you had a child, the lady was supposed to raise the child for the first 3 months, then turn it over to the state and get back to the work. Folks, totally destroy the family. Well, what have we done in America? We've basically done the same thing. We've just voluntarily done it. The family no longer means anything. There's no family government. The church has become meaningless as we no longer stand for right and wrong and fight against sin. We just want to be popular. We want to be liked. We just want big numbers rather than transformed lives and transforming the culture. And if you do away with those three realms of government, what's left? All that's left to take care of every problem is the civil authority. And what have we become accustomed to even in Oklahoma? Oh, we need the state to fix this. We need the state to fix that. We need the state to take care of this. Folks, that's not what we want. What we need is a revival of morality in America. And see, that's what our second president said. John Adams said this, which is most concerning to me. He said, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions that are unbridled by morality and religion." In other words, we don't have a government that can take care of people that aren't bridled by morality. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. So if you're not capable of making good decisions by yourself, then you cannot have freedom. You must be ruled over and controlled, which is the direction Israel went, as every man did that which was right in his own eyes. And it's the direction that we are currently going. But Israel didn't have a king. God didn't give them one. God gave them his law. And they were to be self-governing. They were supposed to be a righteous people, capable of freedom. We know that Israel eroded morally, doing what was right in their own eyes. And rather than trusting God by obeying his directions and enjoying his blessings, they did it their way. And they made a wreck out of things. And they concluded, "We need a king. We need a strong arm of a central government that can take care of us when we have needs and protect us from our enemies and tell us what to do." How did God respond to that idea? If you remember, God told Samuel, they're not going to like it. If they have a king, he's going to take their stuff, he's going to take their land, he's going to take their sons, he's going to take their daughters, they're not going to like it. You go back and tell them, they're not going to like it. It's not for their best. But they didn't trust God. What do you mean, Pastor? They didn't trust God? No, they didn't trust God. How so? They didn't trust what God had told him to do. They didn't trust God's wisdom. They wanted to be protected and ruled over by an earthly monarch just like every other nation. They weren't rejecting Samuel. God said, "They're rejecting me." Now, folks, with this biblical background, it's important that we remember what America once was and how we were designed to operate, but we have conveniently forgotten. In the few remaining minutes we have, let me remind you. Woodrow Wilson was one of the worst presidents our country ever had. Under his leadership, he worked to centralize power. We established a national bank. We didn't have a national income tax until Wilson was in office. By the way, understand the power to tax is the power to control and the power to destroy. That's one reason, or that is the reason why churches aren't taxed. Because churches aren't supposed to be controlled or under the threat of destruction by the central governing authority. Also, under Adams, he changed the way that the Senate was designed to operate, and we've been in a downhill slide ever since. But before he was elected president, when he was the president of Princeton University, as a progressive, he wrote an article that was published in Political Science Quarterly in July of 1887. And let me summarize what it says as you see it on the screen. In layman's terms, he said, what one generation would resist, recognizing that it's not right, but would eventually give up and just accept, the next generation would accept it because their parents had done so, and every successive generation would operate under the principle that it's always been that way. Ladies and gentlemen, today we believe that 320 million people are ruled by an all-powerful president with a phone and a pen, or by a Supreme Court. Neither is true. Last week we looked at the thinking of our founding fathers. They, believing that natural law defined the purpose of government was to protect man, not to oppress man, and believing that England had violated that law and had violated the charters which limited their authority and defined the responsibilities of both parties, and, as Mr. Jefferson said in the Declaration, after a long train of abuse and usurpations and pleas for righteous rule from the king, were all rejected. Finally, the Second Continental Congress on July 2nd, 1776, voted to accept the Lee Resolution and seceded from British tyranny. 2 days later, after haggling on the final wording, they signed the Declaration of Independence, and the 13 British colonies became what? One nation? No. 13 sovereign states. Basically, 13 independent nations. Now understand, each of these states had their own constitution, and they were very Christ-centered. I'll show you just one, which I have done frequently, but I love this one. This is my favorite, and all of them are overtly Christian, but Delaware perhaps leads the way. In order to serve in the Delaware government, which, by the way, Delaware was a nation, it was the nation state of Delaware, in order to serve in politics, you had to be a Christian. Article 22, every person shall have been chosen a member of either house or appointed to any office or place of trust before taking his seat or entering upon the execution of his office shall make and subscribe the following declaration. I, state your name, do profess faith in God the Father and in Jesus Christ, his Holy Son, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore. And I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by a divine inspiration. You can join most churches easier today than you could serve in the Delaware legislature back then. But understand, you had to understand that there was absolute truth. There is right and wrong. It is fixed. It's not arbitrary. There is one lawmaker and lawgiver. And also you had to realize that there's going to be a day of accounting. And when no one is watching you, a Christian knows that someone is watching him. Therefore, you know to be accountable, you must always do right, even when nobody with physical eyes are around the room. Now, folks, after declaring independence, obviously, as we all know historically, King George didn't just say, well, good luck, guys, I hope you make it. No, the 13 colonies, or now 13 states, had to fight to finalize their independence. So they agreed to enter into a formal union to work together for their general welfare and their common defense. Our first constitution was called the Articles of Confederation. Notice some of the comments up here. This is where we first see the term, the United States of America. Notice also that they didn't become one nation, but they were a confederacy, a union. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. In other words, if the state didn't give the authority to the general government, the general government didn't have the authority to do it. The said states hereby individually enter into a firm league of friendship with each other for their common defense, the security of their liberties, and their mutual and general welfare. Well, as you know, the good guys won. We successfully defended our Declaration of Independence, and in the Treaty of Paris in 1783, the peace was finally resolved. And notice what's expressed here. This was not a treaty between the nation of England and the nation of the United States. No, it was a treaty of peace between England and New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia to be free and sovereign and independent states, and even uses the pronoun them and not it. 4 years later, they got together in Philadelphia in an effort to strengthen the Articles of Confederation, and in order to form a more perfect union, they came up with what we have today. Now, folks, understand. Please listen. This wasn't an agreement between the states and the federal government. This was an agreement between the states creating the federal government. By the way, think of what Blackstone said. Man, considered as a creature, must necessarily be subject to the laws of his creator. Wait a second. So the created answers to the creator. Let me ask you a question. Did the federal government create the states, or did the states create the federal government? That's exactly right. Man, or these states got together, created, designed, and delegated limited power to this new general government that was supposed to take care of their general welfare and their common defense. Now, folks, knowing the sin nature of man, and whenever power is concentrated, man becomes abusive. So what few powers were delegated to this new general government were themselves divided within the federal government. Now look at what we've got here, and this is very brief, but it's just understand, it's important that you have a basic understanding. I was always taught in school that we had three co-equal branches in Washington. We do not. Article 1 created the most important group, the legislature, which represents the people. Article 2 created the executive, which carries out the will of the people. Article 3 created the least important and the least powerful, which was this puny Supreme Court. Now understand how well they designed this. You had the House of Representatives, which was representing the people. So states with a greater population had more representatives. By the way, they had an important responsibility. All spending bills come from the House of Representatives. Why is that? Listen, the state doesn't have any money. There's no such thing as public funds. The only money the state has, whether it be Washington, D.C. or the state of Oklahoma, is what it takes from the taxpayers or what it borrows and the taxpayers are on the line to repay. Therefore, all spending bills must come from the House of Representatives, which represent the people. Does that make perfect sense? Our founders are pretty smart guys, God-fearing, intelligent men. The Senate had equal representation, and it represented each state. And it didn't matter whether you were a state with California and the population that they have, or a state the size of Montana with the small population that they have, each state was equally represented. By the way, the senators weren't elected by a vote of the people. The senators were placed there by a vote of the state legislature, because the senator's not supposed to be representing you. The senator's supposed to represent the state of Oklahoma. You've got somebody that represents you. That's Steve Russell. But again, poor leadership by Wilson led in this state or a popular vote of electing our senators. And now we have the mess that we have. And then we had the second branch, the president, charged with the responsibility of not ruling with a phone and a pen. He was charged with the responsibility of carrying out the will of the people. And the will of the people was decided by Congress. Now, folks, think of this. In the first five presidential administrations, George Washington served two terms. John Adams served one term. Thomas Jefferson served two terms. James Madison served two terms. James Monroe served two terms. Period of 36 years, they issued a total of 15 executive orders and 10 presidential vetoes. Out of 36 years, that wasn't even a good day for our last president. Because they didn't believe that the president was supposed to rule over the people. The president was supposed to carry out the will of the people as demonstrated by the legislature. And then finally, you had the Supreme Court. By the way, read Article 3, Section 2. You find out their limited responsibility was differences between states, differences between individuals from different states, maritime law and everything else. I guarantee you what you won't find is you won't find anywhere in there where they have the authority to force states to legalize the murder of preborn children, nor will you find where they have any authority to force the redefinition of marriage on the states. By the way, you'll also not find in the Constitution any idea of judicial review. The Supreme Court's supposed to interpret the law. Please show me that in the Constitution. It's not there. You know who gave the Supreme Court that power? The Supreme Court. Wouldn't you like to have that kind of power every day of life? You know what? I don't have that power, but I'm going to give it to myself. Well, that's what happened, and we've been operating that way ever since. But folks, only Congress had the power to make laws, and their power was defined and limited by Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. In fact, Federalist Paper number 45 addressed this very issue. It said this: the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution of the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The former, being the federal government, will be exercised principally on external objects such as war, peace, and negotiation and foreign commerce, with which, the most part, the power of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. The powers reserved to the individual states will extend to all objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. The operations of the federal government will be most extensive and important in times of war and danger, those in state governments in times of peace and prosperity. Is that difficult to understand? No. So let me ask you this. Where do they have the authority to redefine marriage? Where do they have the authority to force the legalization of abortion on our country? They don't. Well, who's supposed to be the defender of liberty within each state? It's supposed to be the state. Remember Blackstone? The created is subject to the creator. Let me ask you again, who created whom? Did the states create the federal government? Did the federal government create the states? And remember man's sin nature, ladies and gentlemen. We're almost done. And I hope you see the application here. America hasn't been exceptional by accident. Our founding fathers were devoted God-fearing men. Sinful men, yes, but devoted God-fearing men. And because they took biblical truths and tried to apply it into what we have enjoyed the greatest run of Christian history in planet Earth. And just as sure as we're abandoning it, we're going to find ourselves losing our Christian liberty. Folks, I don't want my grandkids living in the catacombs again. But that's a direction we're heading unless we understand that Christianity isn't just for Sunday morning, that Jesus is the Lord of every facet of our lives, and we start trying to apply a biblical worldview in every facet of our lives. But our founding fathers, even as pure as they were with their intent in 1776, they understood man's sin nature. Folks, this is amazing to me. You know, power is always a problem when somebody else has it, but when I've got it, it's not a problem anymore. Yeah, John Adams, great hero of liberty in 1776. We ratify the Constitution of actually the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, by what, 1791? And within 7 years, John Adams, as president, leads in passing a law with his political party that made it illegal to say bad things about the president. Now think about John Adams. John Adams had actually led in saying King George is a knucklehead, and now he passes a law that says you can't say anything bad about the president. Well, this was clearly illegal, clearly unconstitutional. So whose responsibility was it to say no? Well, Madison, who wrote our Constitution, credited with being the chief author, said in case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties to the Constitution have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for the arresting of the progress of evil and for maintaining within their respected limits, Oklahoma governs Oklahoma, Texas governs Texas, the authorities, rights, and liberties pertaining to them. He went on and said in a report to his own legislature in Virginia, the Constitution of the United States was formed by the sanction of the states, given each in its sovereign capacity. It adds to the stability and dignity as well as the authority of the Constitution that it rests on this legitimate and solid foundation. The states then being the parties to the constitutional compact and in their sovereign capacity, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal, no Supreme Court, above their authority, decide in the last resort whether the Constitution was violated. And consequently, that as the parties to it, they must themselves decide in the last resort such questions as may be sufficient magnitude to require their interposition. Dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by other departments. In other words, it's not just the legislative branch, not just the executive branch, but the judicial branch can overstep their boundaries as well. Consequently, the ultimate right of the parties to the Constitution to judge whether the compact has been dangerously violated must extend to the violations by one delegated authority as well as by another, by the judiciary as well as by the executive or the legislature. So again, going back to Blackstone, the created is subject to the creator. Who created the federal government? Is the Supreme Court a part of the federal government? Is the Supreme Court supposed to be arbitrating between the states and the federal government? No. Thomas Jefferson, who penned the Declaration, said this: individual states composing the United States of America are not united on a principle of unlimited submission to their general government, but that by a compact under the style and the title of a Constitution for the United States and of amendments thereto, they, being the states, constituted a general government for special purposes, delegated to that government certain definite powers. Defined powers is what definite means. In other words, they're not just unlimited, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of right of their own self-government, and that whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, in other words, if it legally can't do it, then it's illegal. Its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. Folks, when Roe versus Wade was passed, by the way, have you noticed the liberals out there today saying, we've got to riot, we've got to go out and do all this and that? You know what should have happened in 1973? The churches should have rioted. Churches said, we're not killing our babies. Where were we? Blood of 60-plus million babies are on our hands, folks. 2015, when the Supreme Court illegally redefined marriage, you know what the 30 states that had constitutionally defined marriage as one man and one woman in their state, you know what those 30 governors should have done? Hey, we appreciate your opinion, but not in our state. The law in our state is that marriage is one man and one woman, and the church should have been there to support them. But instead, the church is busy trying to be Gumby and flexible to conform to the will of the popularity of the Hollywood culture. Folks, the concept of the Constitution, a limited federal government with strong state governments, is the only way that 320 million people can possibly coexist. Let me ask you this. Do you think the values of Oklahoma are the same as those of Massachusetts? No, not at all. So Massachusetts can be Massachusetts. Oklahoma can be Oklahoma. We work together for our common defense and for our general welfare. And quite frankly, if Massachusetts wants to legalize abortion, then may they bring God's curse upon them. But if Oklahoma claims to fear God, and we wish to not allow the murder of our babies, then we should have every right to do so. Now, here's the argument against that. Pastor, what about slavery? Didn't the South use the idea of states' rights to fight for slavery? Yes, they did, ladies and gentlemen. But what you don't realize is before that, many of the northern states used the power of states' rights to fight against slavery. When the Alien and Sedition Act was passed, when the Dred Scott case was passed, many of the northern states, one of the most famous was Wisconsin in 1850, said, no, not in our state. a black man gets to our state, he's free, and you're not going to take him from us. And let me just answer that question with this. Understand, as we saw last week, our founders believed that there is ultimately one lawgiver, that being God. And our founders repeatedly said that man cannot make a law that contradicts or violates God's law. Therefore, if God has dealt with the issue, it's settled. Well, has God dealt with slavery? Yes, he has. Exodus 21, he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. Slavery was a death penalty. Folks, what we don't understand is as you read your King James Bible, slavery is talked about that was not like slavery of the 1800s in America. You could enslave yourself for up to 6 years through servitude. You could enslave yourself because you were required to pay a debt back. You couldn't just declare bankruptcy. And by the way, that's the right thing to do. But as far as stealing a man and taking his labor from him, that was a violation of God's law and has always been illegal. When something is morally wrong, it should never be declared legal and right by a state. What about abortion? Well, abortion violates God's law throughout the Bible, from the First Testament to the Latter Testament. Children are a gift from God, given to parents to be raised in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It was only the pagans and the idolaters that would burn their babies alive in the fires of Moloch, Ashtaroth, and Baal. What about same-sex marriage? All through Bible, beginning in Genesis chapter 2, where we see what God's design was for the Bible. And throughout the Bible, homosexuality has always been condemned as a sin which goes against natural law itself. And marriage is defined as one man and one woman, period. So if something violates God's law, man should never declare it legal and right. So folks, as we look back at the original, Israel's original design was a commonwealth of righteous, self-governing people in their sovereign geographic tribes or states. They were unified and governed by not by an all-powerful man, but they were governed by the written Torah, their written constitution. We see America's original design was a voluntary union of righteous, self-governing people in their sovereign states, unified and governed not by an all-powerful man, but by our written Constitution. Please understand that America has been exceptional. We have been the freest, most prosperous, most respected, most sought-after country in world history. We have done more for world charity. We have done more for world missions than any other country in world history. And we're the only country in 2,000 years to provide Christians with civil liberty and religious liberty. And as I said a while ago, ladies and gentlemen, it is not by accident. Well, why is it then? For this reason. And we'll close with this, and please let this sink in. And I know this message probably goes against your grain because you've been brought up in the American church. And the American church is only supposed to talk about heaven. And the American church is only supposed to talk about this little portion of the Bible right over. We're just going to ignore the first 39 books. Oh, that's old. We don't talk about that. Well, there's just one chapter, John 3. That's what we can talk about. And we won't talk about Revelation because that's confusing and controversial. We won't talk about this because we don't know. We have limited what we teach in the American church. So it goes against our grain if we think, oh, we're not supposed to talk about sexuality. Wait a second, where are you supposed to learn it? On the walls of the bathroom at the high school? Who created sexuality? Yeah. So you think we ought to be yielding to his wisdom on the subject? Should we be yielding to God's instruction on the family? Should we be yielding to God's instruction on the roles of the design of the family? Should we be yielding to God's instruction about honesty, integrity, work ethic? Should we? I don't know. Let me ask you. I mean, what part of Jesus, by the way, is Jesus not the Lord of? For most Christians, Jesus isn't Lord of most of your lives. Folks, everything that we do, the closer we get to doing it God's way, whether it's your family or whether it's a country, it always works out best. That's the whole point. That's why we were birthed in the first place. That's why we were once great, never perfect. America has always had its blemishes. We all know full well. But America has been exceptional when compared to the rest.